Hi, I'm Daniel Eilenberg, guest hosting Worldwise on Blogging Heads from Miami. I'm here with Diego Sr., who's in Bogota. I am a journalist living and working between Miami and Mexico. I have also worked in Colombia, where I produced a documentary for National Geographic detailing Operación Jaque, which was the rescue by the military forces of Ingrid Betancourt. Three Americans and 12 members of the armed forces in Colombia. I'm currently the president of Animal Político, a political website in Mexico. Diego, why don't you tell us a little about yourself, please?
Well, I'm Diego Senior. I live here in Bogota, Colombia. I've been working for 10 years in journalism. I have devoted most of my working career to radio news. I was 7 years working in New York City as a news correspondent for Caracol Radio, which is a company that I continue to work here. It's Colombia's largest news radio network, and I also work with other radios in the continent that belong to Prisa, which is a Hispanic conglomerate in media, mostly radios from Argentina to Mexico, Chile, Panama, and Spain, of course, where the headquarters office is. And now I work as an advisor to Caracol Radio CEO here in Bogota in content-related issues and in journalism endeavors.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for being with us today, Diego, and thanks for your time. Why don't we start by briefly recapping a little bit. Today we'll be talking about the conflict between the Colombian government and the FARC guerrillas, and discussing in particular the peace efforts that will be underway sometime between the 8th and the 14th of October. There are different reports right now as to when exactly these will start. But they should be starting in the next couple of weeks. So, Diego, for our audience, why don't we start by perhaps introducing who the FARC are, how they form, and how this very, very old guerrilla movement has developed over the years into what they are today.
Well, officially, they were created in 1964, but their existence and their work dates back to the early 50s in Colombia. This is where several movements of leftist ideology and of liberal thought, part of what the liberal political party was back then, decided to run away to the forests and to the jungles of Colombia, pressured out by the threat of a military government installed by a general in a coup d'etat that happened in 1953. They also were born as a show or as a proof of lack of confidence facing the status quo back then, immediately after the coup d'etat ended and after this authoritarian regime ended in Colombia. Immediately after this, a union between the liberal party and the conservative party happened. It's called Frente Nacional, in which they decided to interchange the years that they would be in power. 4 years the liberals, 4 years the conservatives. At some point, Frente Nacional gives some of the 5,000 liberals that originally fled to the woods in the right-wing government of Pinilla, and they gave them an option to return to society in the cities. They did. They were betrayed by some of the people of the establishment, and most of them were killed. So what we see now in the FARC are the reminders of these leftists and liberals that escaped political violence in Colombia and decided to retaliate with also an arms taken ideology and, of course, in different parts of the jungles of mainly central, south, and western Colombia. Some of the leftists and liberals that go back to participate in the political arena are murdered. This always happened in the Cold War framework. So anyone that had any kind of communist ideology or similar to that would be persecuted and prosecuted as well. So this in 1964 is when they are formed, and the FARC are born as a group, as an organization. They have evolved through different means of finding finances. Two of those are the ones that have been mostly shown and open to the public, which are basically kidnappings and narcotraffic as well. This happens in the late 80s, the interchange between sustaining a guerrilla war and guerrilla warfare with only political and monetary kidnappings, to inheriting the business of narcotraffickers around Colombia after the cartels are brought down by the government together with the forces of the United States of America, basically.
Very well. And next week, or sometime right after that, a new peace process will begin. Some earlier steps of this peace process have already taken place in Havana, and the basic the basic ground rules have been set for what will happen in the next few weeks or months. But this is not Colombia's first peace process. Colombia had had some successful peace processes in the past and some not as successful. The successful ones include the demobilization of the M19, the M19, which is a guerrilla group that became a political factor in Colombia and continues to be an important political factor in some form, or some of its former members continue to be very politically active. But the peace negotiations with the FARC have not gone so far the way the government would like them to go. And the last effort was perhaps the most notable, was under President Pastrana in 1999 to 2002, where a large chunk of the Colombian territory was vacated by the government to set the ground for these negotiations. And that resulted in a much stronger, emboldened guerrilla that never quite came to the negotiating table with the best intentions, and so a peace agreement never materialized. And I think that left a bit of a sour taste for most Colombians. Can you tell us a little bit about how Colombians are feeling about this new peace process?
How we are seeing this peace process? Well, Colombia is excited always, and you can ask anyone, any person in the country or any Colombian outside the world about the possibility of peace. It's been more than 50 years of conflict in Colombia with different guerrillas and then with paramilitary organizations and with lack of state presence in many parts of the national territory. And most generations that are pulling the country together now and that are working for the country have never even seen one day without violence. That's actually a catchphrase that President Álvaro Uribe Vélez, former President Álvaro Uribe Vélez, would always say, which is actually true. Many generations, three or four at least, that are now in the struggling, getting a job, getting a family, creating society per se, have never seen a moment without the existence of any political or armed conflict in the country. 72% of the Colombians are very excited about the possibility, according to latest polls by important pollsters. One of them is Ipsos Napoleon Franco, one of the most respected pollsters in Colombia. They have determined through their research that 72% of Colombians are indeed supporting the process, and most of them are also optimistic, but also cautious. That is, it's cautious optimism. That's the phrase that they have coined. Again, 77% are actually not intending, are not pretending to support the participation of the FARC in a political establishment that might come out of that peace process. So it's a little bit of a contradiction in the terms of what the Colombians are willing to pay for in order to achieve peace.
Right, so the Colombians are excited about peace, but not really ready to make some of the sacrifices that might be needed for that. And this is actually a point I want to come back to in a little bit. But first, Diego, is there a reason for the timing of this negotiation?
Yes, the timing is actually perfect for the negotiations to take place. Basically, because the guerrillas have come to a point of of diminished influence, both in the military levels and in the credibility within the public opinion approach to them, both within and outside our frontiers and our borders. So
sure.
They are as weak as they have ever been. They were created in 1964, as we just mentioned, with about 3,000 members. They have now been able to create a force that surpassed the 10,000 members, close to 11, and now they're back to half of that. They always have different numbers, so you never exactly know how many people are taking part in their movement and in what levels. But you can clearly know that their capability of infiltrating and taking power as they were born, and that's the reason of their existence, is almost non-existent. And then they have mm-hmm. been forced into this point of negotiating. They have found themselves three times like this in the past, and decisions by governments at those particular times in history have led them and opened a way into a new, as the Phoenix would do, reemergence of their own ashes, basically. And as you just mentioned, that time in 1998, between 1998 and 2002, was crucial for them to reorganize themselves, to find a new territory, a territory that is a land mm-hmm. of the size of Denmark and or Switzerland. It's a third of the country of Colombia was given to them back then. So they were able to organize to control the fields of production of cocaine and continue with their kidnappings and their extortions. They now have seen sure. that the successes of the past government have been able to punch through some of the walls and the buffers that they have created in the past in order to maintain themselves in a unity. Those walls have been destroyed and brought down, particularly within their own communications amongst themselves. And proof of that is La Operación Jaque, which you know much about, in which their own internal communications amongst the most high-level ranking officers in the organization, where their communications were interrupted, and they were, of course, misguided into believing that they were giving a certain group of important hostages to an organization, which in reality they were just giving them, freeing them into the arms of the government. So after that, you can see that Alfonso Cano, Mono Jojoy, Raúl Reyes, three of the most important leaders of this guerrilla, have been brought down in different organized attacks by the government and the military forces, and they need this moment. So they need it either to regroup and reorganize, like in the past, or actually to achieve peace and go back into society with what you could call a little bit of a high standard, or you're holding their heads up high, as they would they prove themselves to be back in that press conference that they gave about 3 weeks ago in Havana, in which you could see them as not afraid of going into a conversation, but you could see that they were untrained, and all they had was their inner beliefs that will be debated in the peace processes, and that feeling of a higher morality. That's the way they see themselves, and that's what they're trying to prove with entering this peace process now.
Sure, and I think a key condition to reassure the Colombian citizenship that the same will not happen again has been President Santos' statement that there will be no ceasefire during this negotiation, and that there are no preset demands for the negotiation. So, going into those demands and those points, what exactly is at stake? What is it that's going to be negotiated over the next weeks and months, first in Norway, in Oslo, and then in Havana, in Cuba?
Yeah, well, there's five main points that they want to, that both the government and the guerrillas have established as crucial in order to start the negotiations, and they will be dealt in depth, each one of them. The first one is related to agriculture, it's land ownership and rural development. The second one is political mm-hmm. participation. The third one is an actual end to the physical violence, to the conflict per se. The fourth one is a proposal of an end to illicit production of illegal drugs. And the fifth one is a direct relation to victims and how to repair victims of the conflict that has lasted 50 years. I don't know if you want to go into any of them in particular at this moment or...
Well, I think the first one in particular is one that is not as evident as the other might be, and it's also a very key component of not only this conflict but just fighting poverty in general in Colombia. So why don't we go into that one, the land issue here?
Well, the current distribution of illegal is illegal according to the FARC. The current distribution of land, of course, the legality of it. They have taken most of the land by force, making extortions on former peasants and workers, and creating propaganda amongst them, trying to make them be part of the guerrillas. And they think that the opportunities for these very same peasants and workers that they have, extorted in the past, are not as the same opportunities as people in the main ruler and main cities have had in the past. They are trying to fight big landowners and actually the cattle owners. Landowners and cattle owners are an important piece of the Colombian exporting machine. And these
sure.
From them actually,
and many of them oppose. And many of them oppose this peace negotiation.
Yeah, and actually, they come, the paramilitary forces come from landowners that are tired of being harassed by the FARC. So the FARC don't see the status quo of the land distribution in Colombia as something fair, either to them or to the peasants that they try to bring into their lines. They actually, in the first peace process, in the second peace process, in the one that we saw in 1998, they wanted and they demanded a complete renovation of the status quo when it comes to agricultural standards and to land ownership. That, of course, won't happen, and they have realized this. They are more lean and more keen to understand what is the land ownership right now in Colombia and what are the laws that the government has and to discuss them. That is a huge step forward, actually,
sure.
Because before they were demanding a complete change. They now know that they cannot do this and that that will not happen. They're not in the position to do it. But it's a very tricky point. Why? The Ministry of Agriculture says that due to a law that prohibits any ownership of land around 5 kilometers squared around anywhere where there is research and on either mining or oil, these are perishable goods, exploration areas. There is forbidden to
sure.
give land to private people, to private ownership. So this very law has
right.
to change, and it's in the Constitution. It would have to change in a mandatory manner in order to the peace negotiations to succeed. This is only one of the many points that have to be revised in this process. So you can see what the level of detail is in these negotiations. This is only just one of four of the main topics.
Absolutely. And speaking of these challenges, there are, of course, the internal challenges of the negotiation, the points that are going to be negotiated. But in this case, there's also some external factors that are playing a big role in this negotiation. One of them is, of course, former President Álvaro Uribe, who is deeply opposed to these peace negotiations and continues to be a very popular and influential force in Colombian politics. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that and about some of the other pressures and difficulties that you think this process is going to have going forward?
Yeah, well, the difficulties that they face are in different levels. The cattle and landowners that don't want the status quo to change because this is land that they have apparently rightfully acquired and that they believe that is, you know, part of a private enterprise and should not be distributed amongst anybody else. And they actually have papers to prove it. the legality of each of the papers has to be, you know, talked about and discussed, and many people are not willing to do this. And the feeling that they have is represented in Álvaro Uribe. He is a landowner as well. That is his origin. That is how he made his money with both cattle and creating horses and having huge masses of land. He also opposes, and he has a very important influence over current politicians, the current politicians that are in the Congress that also helped get Santos into power. They feel that he himself feels betrayed by Santos, who was one of his most important ministers back in 2008 and 2012 and 2010 and 2009. These are different years that had an influence on how the policies of democratic security that Álvaro Uribe invented took place and were empowered and actually got society to grow as in economic level and international security level. He feels that everything that he created in those 8 years of government is now challenged by the very existence and possibility of a peace process. That is one of the most difficulties because sure. Santos needs Congress and needs the support of Congress in order to approve a framework for peace, which is a set of standards that will change the constitution in order to the peace process results to be in place. If one of the two, the second point in the talking points for the peace process is political participation. If you want the FARC to participate in Colombian politics, at some point you will have to change the constitution. He already foresaw this, and that is why the framework for peace is being debated in Congress. But Congress is also very influenced by this former president. That's one of the many obstacles that the peace process is facing. Another one is the negotiators themselves. I don't know if you want to talk about that right now, but one of the most important negotiators on the FARC side is currently... It was extradited years ago and is currently facing a long sentence in the United States of America. And they want him, and he has demanded Simon Trinidad.
Sure. So just to give our viewers a little background on the FARC negotiating side, you're going to have Simon Trinidad, who you just mentioned was arrested a few years back and is serving a 60-year sentence here in the United States. And he has requested that he be allowed to participate in these negotiations, and he has in fact asked President Juan Manuel Santos to intervene on his behalf and to please request that the U.S. government allow him to travel to participate in these talks. But you also have Sargento Pascuas, who's the last remaining founding member of the FARC. The last original founder, the last original guerrillero from the FARC, who's around 80 years old, and you also have Iván Márquez, who's one of the most important ideologues of the FARC, and who also participated in the last round of negotiations with then President Andrés Pastrana. And then on the government side, you also have a pretty interesting team. That's made up of two generals. One is the former Colombian chief of the police, Oscar Naranjo, who gave some of the hardest hits to the FARC. And you also have Jorge Enrique Mora, who served as a general of the armed forces during President Uribe's first term. So he's also a hardliner. In his views towards the FARC. You also have a very important Colombian businessman as part of the negotiation table. So, Diego, why don't you tell us a little bit about what this tells us about what is to come in this negotiation?
Well, you're asking me to talk about the negotiators per se, because I see something, an interesting pattern there that I wanted to portray.
Go ahead.
Great. The pattern is that both of the sides have hardliners in their teams. Both of the negotiating parts sure. have hardliners in their teams, and these are people that have that truly are convinced of their beliefs when it comes on standards for security or political participation, et cetera, et cetera. The fact that they bring them to the table, that the state has chosen these people and that the FARC has chosen these other people, in particular the names that you give, shows that both of the parts are compromised in achieving something. This means that mm-hmm. at the end, whether the results of the conversations are a failure, and nothing happens, both of the parts can tell their own hardliners within their parts. The FARC can go back to the jungles and talk to their ideologists and to their most convinced followers that they gave everything that they had to. Both that will happen also in the government side. That is a positive aspect to the conversation. And another factor that I see interesting.
Sure, and it also guarantees that in success. You can sell it to your constituents, right? I mean, you had the toughest people out there negotiating, so you probably got the best possible deal.
Exactly. There's also Sergio Jaramillo there in the side of negotiating team in Colombia. He is a very interesting character of a mellow, analytical, and very not talkative negotiator, which is interesting because that's the person who will be making very important decisions and who will not be necessarily willing to explain them to a public or to a press conference if there's a press conference afterwards. And that's something that you need when you're negotiating. Sure. When the best scenario for these peace talks to take place would be a media-free scenario, since it's not happening, since they have approached media already. I know that for a fact, and they are both sides. Actually, you have seen that the guerrilla members have never given an interview in the past 10 years, and now they're giving interviews once mm-hmm. or twice a week, three times a week, to radios, to newspapers, to television networks, all of them local. But you can never. This is something that is not building ground for the negotiations themselves.
Absolutely, and it actually takes me to another one of the points I wanted to discuss, and that's the media's role in this negotiation. As you know well, the media in Colombia has been an important player in this conflict. It's not only been a very valiant partner in the fight for security in Colombia, but it's also been a very serious victim of attacks. Journalists have been targeted for many, many years in Colombia. El Espectador, which was, I believe, at the time Colombia's second largest newspaper, was bombed and destroyed. So the media has had always a big role to play in this conflict. What do you think the media's role will be now during the negotiation, and are there any things that the media needs to watch out for?
Well, I think the media and the Colombian media will be, actually not only Colombian media, I think the worldwide media as well. They will help to reach a positive or a negative outcome, willingly or not, and they will work as catalyzers for failure or catalyzers for success. And in this order, I'm giving this a thought, and I think that there are three important ways in which media have to change. I talk now about only Colombian media, that is the one that more in touch with Colombian reality, and of course more in touch with this process that is beginning. There are three ways that I really feel that we should reconsider our way of acting, and I say we because I work for a radio in Colombia. One of them is a change of speed of information. The obsession with breaking news, the obsession with notoriety, with national breaking news, and with personalities goes, I think, directly against achieving peace. Achieving peace is a is a very long and complicated process that we just saw. Many, many different points are not newsworthy, and in our intentions of making any kind of data that might come out of those tables, transforming them into newsworthy items, we can completely put become a hazard for the process. We are not observers. We are actually influencers in the outcome of this process, if we claim it or either we want it or not. That's one point. The second one is a change of the treatment of information. The interviews to the guerrilla members are actually happening all the time. Our news radio hasn't opened microphones to them just yet because of a certain level of skepticism that I think is in order, because we need to realize that either when the government or when the guerrillas are talking to a microphone, they're not trying to talk to the public. In the middle, and this is in the framework of a peace negotiations process. In that framework, the two parts that are discussing and the two parts that are trying to end a conflict, they will be talking. They will be using the media to talk to their most hardline constituencies, as we just said it minutes before. And if the media has this clear, we will be able to clean the message and get what's real and get the facts. We often, Colombian media does that, we forget about the facts and we go into opinion and to creating discussions and mostly in radio. And that's a mea culpa that I have because I know that radio is a very important media in Colombia for different reasons. And we look to fill up space with opinions. And opinions sometimes, if you have over-opinionated media, then the facts get diluted and are not shown right to your face like you should. And finally, the other way to improve the coverage would be a change of discourse. As I told you, there's 50, 60 years of violence in Colombia. We only know the war discourse in the media, which is who is the oppressor, who is making what wrong, and how can that person be punished and stopped, which it could be okay. But then if you change into a peace discourse, you're thinking about not who is the oppressor, but what are the issues and how can the issues be resolved, regardless of the people that are acting. And this is a long list that media theorists have always tried to promote in conflict areas, particularly in Africa, where the media the media development has been fascinating. And there's a lot to learn from those scenarios right here in Colombia.
That's interesting thoughts about the role of the media there, and that you touch on something that that I find is quite critical here. That is the acceptance of these fighters into society, the reintegration of fighters into society. We're talking about fairly large armies in a country with, you know, over 10% unemployment, with over 35% poverty. These are not easy economic goals to achieve, to reintegrate these people, to give them a viable livelihood in this economy. So it's a real challenge not only to bring them into society, but then there's also the other aspect or the other side of that equation, which is the victims. You have a lot of victims in Colombia from a very, very long conflict who want, and rightly so, feel like there should be some justice paid for the victims. So Colombia has some experience with this. They created the Ley de Justicia y Paz, the peace and justice legislation, to reintegrate paramilitary fighters into society, and that had some good results and some other not so good results, so they have to adjust over time for, and it's been a little bit of a work in progress. So I think there's some sort of legal framework for this kind of transitional judicial mechanism, but it's a key component of solving this kind of conflict. How is Colombia addressing that this time? What are the lessons that Colombia has learned from these past processes? And how do Colombians feel about that aspect of the problem in particular?
Well, Colombia has learned that it is going to be a long and hard road to integration, and that integration back into society from members that are holding their arms, when they give their arms back, they need something to do. Otherwise, they will go back into violence, as we saw with the paramilitary members that demobilized and then eventually turned into local gangs in different cities around the country. With that lesson learned...
Which happened with the paramilitaries.
Yes, exactly. With that lesson learned, they have created, or the government has been promoting, what they call a peace framework. Marco para la paz. Mm-hmm. And this peace framework is intended to change those very particular points of the Constitution that relate to people that have committed crimes, how to judge those crimes and how to get them close to victims. Again, they have tried actually in the past with the paramilitaries to make example out of them, like bring people and children in schools, go visit them at their jails and have interviews with them and openly helping them write books or whatever so they can spread their message and regret of what they did and to show society what is the best way to approach a life after being part of an illegal band. But what is real now is that most of the important leaders within the guerrillas, within the FARC, have committed crimes against humanity. And the Statute of Rome says clearly that no person that has committed a crime against humanity is allowed to participate in any political process in any country where that person has committed those crimes. And Colombia signed that treaty and that statute, and Colombia would have to involve international transitional justice in this particular point. That would be the second point of the peace talks that will be starting in Oslo on the 14th of October. So it is a very tricky process, and it's a process that has not proved to be completely successful or successful at all in our case. There is not, and I don't see any sustainability for works that can be, or programs that can be started in the countryside in order to turn former soldiers into farmers. And here's where the narco-traffic business takes place. Why? Because it's of course, it's more reliable and it's more profitable to have one finca, which is a farm, the space that a farm occupies, to have that dedicated to coca fields than to potatoes or fruit or bananas or whatever other exports that Colombia has. Colombia produces, till this day, and it's a very known fact, 95% of the cocaine consumed in the world, and is now amongst the top 10 cocaine consumers, not only producers, but consumers in the world. So the situation, the geography, the closeness to Brazil. Brazil is the second or third largest country that consumes cocaine, and most of it comes from Peru, Bolivia, and Colombia. The narco-traffic relation to the political participation and reintegration into society of the guerrilla members is a crucial factor, and is not a factor that depends entirely on the people that are on the table of negotiations. Finishing narco-traffic is not up to guerrillas, or is not up to Colombia on its own, and all the presidents that have traveled to Washington and to New York, to the United Nations General Assembly, have always said it. It's an international issue. So I would like to see how that entails, or how that solves its, how that goes on. Like, what will be the result of that?
Sure. And talking a little bit about this international community, and to round up our conversation, Diego, why don't we discuss a little bit first, what is the role of the international community during these talks, and what is the role, if any, of the United States during these talks? There's a few countries that are directly involved in the negotiation, namely Norway and Cuba are going to be hosting parts of the negotiation, and then there's two accompanying countries, which are going to be Venezuela and Chile, who are sort of accompanying the process and are going to be directly involved in it. Is there a role for the U.S. in this and for the international community in general?
Yes, the international community has to do one thing in particular, and is to give legitimacy to any of the decisions that are taken in that conversation, in that table. Whatever the outcome of the conversations are, the international community will help validate them. And with that, there will be a process, and a second part of the process, if you can call it that, in which the international eyes will be not judging, but yeah, measuring how effective the results of those peace talks were, beyond of whatever the opinions are of the Colombians inside. And why do I think this is important? Because the FARC has always found a way to validate themselves facing certain countries in the European Union that have given them in the past open space for them to go and talk about their beliefs, etc., and all in the flag of being inclusive. Inclusive in the political spectrum. But then again, these are the very same countries that have to realize what would be the final pass of judgment facing the existence of the FARC and what the FARC are and what their demands have been. This is the international arena is built for that for a particular purpose, I think. So we will see how they respond to any outcome that it comes. Now, the United States is a very delicate taken, I think, it has a very delicate position. Why? Because as much as they or like any other country wants peace in Colombia, their private industry and part of the public industry as well is focused on establishing security around the globe or around the areas of the globe that they feel that they have a certain amount of interest. One of them being Latin America. Even though we haven't been on their first line of interests in for the past years, for certain reasons that are outside of this topic, but I really think that if they say something, which they haven't to this day, the Obama administration published a very small statement, which is very delicate and very accurate, I think, which is they are expectant and they support right. anything that happens, as any other country would make. But if they go further to say anything else, that would go directly against the good result in the peace process. Why? Because the FARC see them as the empire and as the big enemy and as the ultimate evil on earth, as we all know, and as Chavez sees them as well. So they have to be extremely delicate in that. Although, and I find very interesting, that one of the most important politicians in Colombia, actually the mayor of Bogota, he holds the second most influential public office in Colombia after the government. He has proposed that the United States take part in this negotiation process. He didn't explain quite well, and this happened wow. only like recently, 2 days ago. But the fact that a person like him, who is himself a demobilized member of the M19 guerrilla movement back in the 80s, says that opens up a door of a possible approach to listening to an opinion from anyone based in Washington. I would highly doubt that they make sure. Any move at all. And because, of course, four countries are more than enough, the ones you mentioned, to take part of, and give support to a peace process without being involved.
Yeah, and the U.S. is really never going to be viewed as an impartial player in this negotiation. And, of course, there's no one that could counterbalance the weight of having the United States in the negotiation. So perhaps they're doing Colombia a favor by not even noticing what's happening there. As you know, it really has not been a big issue here in the media. Of course, we have elections coming up in about a month here in the U.S., and so this really has not been very big news, despite being a historic moment for Colombia. But perhaps that's a good thing for Colombia.
Well, yeah, it's and it's one of those burdens that Americans have to, take every time an international conflict is in their backyard. They can either take a chance and sure. go in there and try to solve it, and then be portrayed as invaders and as foreigners that are trying to control everything, or take their time, analyze, and then be blamed for not doing anything as the largest power on political power on the planet could do, as the Clinton administration faced when everything in Eastern Europe happened in the 1996, if I'm not mistaken. So the American exceptionalism, that's what happens with them.
Excellent. Well, Diego, thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. And thank you very much for your insight into the Colombian conflict and the upcoming peace negotiations.
Thank you for having me.
Bye.